This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Do you ever hide your feelings from others? Silly question. All of us do that. Okay, let me put it this way. Is there a feeling or emotion that you are most likely to keep secret? This hour's guests believe there is one emotional state that most all of us not only take great pains to keep locked away from the world, but in fact often hide from ourselves. That emotion? Shame. So what is shame? Why do we bury it so deep? And what would happen if we didn't? Our experts say the answers are important for those dealing with profound trauma and PTSD, yet also could help most any of us wanting to understand our own life better. Doctors Bethany Teachman, Rafael Triana, and Lennis Echterling will be on hand to explain right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Our call-in number, easy to remember, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Now, we are discussing today an issue that is difficult for most people to talk about, the emotional state known as shame. Yet we have some especially kind and helpful mental health specialists with us. And you just might be willing to ask a question of them, share a story of your own experience, or perhaps someone else's. So please do note our phone line in all numbers, 888-967-2825. Already on the phone with us is a research and clinical psychologist who is part of the psychology department at the University of Virginia and who co-authored a new study examining the role of shame in a number of disorders, Bethany Teachman, here in the Insight Studio, a private practice psychoanalyst who's done extensive work with veterans dealing with PTSD and who serves on the psychiatry department faculty at UVA, Rafael Triana, plus a clinical and research psychologist who's done extensive counseling for disaster survivors and who serves as a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University, Lennis Echterling. Dr. Teachman, Dr. Triana, Dr. Echterling, it's great to have all of you back on Virginia Insight.
Nice to be back.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, Dr. Echterling, a thumbnail sketch from you first, if you would. What is shame and why is it such an important factor in mental health?
First of all, just to clarify that shame is often made distinct from guilt. And guilt is often a feeling that we might have, an emotion that we might experience of distress and regret regarding something we've done. And we would like to make amends or seek forgiveness for that of something we've done external to us. On the other hand, shame is often a profound sense of personal humiliation and mortification that's who we are. And so there's that sense of this is my identity that I am afraid to even expose to others because it is who I am inside. And that has often led to the fact that in psychology, I think, and in psychoanalysis and other perspectives, it's often been the most neglected emotion.
Dr. Teachman?
Yes, I think, you know, that we can recognize that one of the things that makes shame such a powerful emotion and has such a large impact is that rather than simply being upset about a specific behavior, we feel that the transgression or the flaw about ourselves reflects on who we are at a very fundamental level. And so it's not surprising that we see shame being associated with low self-esteem, with low quality of life, and it can greatly impact a person's willingness to talk about the difficulties that they're experiencing, either with loved ones or even to come into therapy and share what's going on for them. So it's a really powerful emotion that can really get in the way for people.
Bethany, you just used a phrase, flaw about ourselves. Talk to me more about that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. What we often see clinically is that people will perceive that there is something about themselves that's really just not acceptable. So, for example, in our own research, we've looked at individuals who have obsessive-compulsive disorder, or you may know it as OCD, and these individuals have intrusive, unwanted thoughts or images that will come to mind for them, sort of unbidden. And often these thoughts or images can be about subjects that can feel very uncomfortable. They can be about violence or taboo sexual images or blasphemous thoughts. And people will feel very shamed for having these thoughts and images. And that alone will make them feel that they are somehow flawed and an immoral or an unacceptable person. Now, the reason I keep referring to it as a perception that they are flawed is because actually it turns out that most of us have these kinds of thoughts and images. But for individuals who go on to develop disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder, they feel a lot of shame about having these thoughts and images and think that it's really a unique experience that they're having. And we see this play out in lots of different disorders. So, for example, in the area of social anxiety disorder or social phobia, the individual may feel shame about their social performance and feel that they are not able to engage with others in a way that is acceptable and feel that this makes them very flawed. We see in disorders like body dysmorphic disorder, where people have a very exaggerated sense about a flaw in their appearance and feel a lot of shame about that and feel that it makes them, again, unacceptable in some way. And because it really goes to this sense of self, the sense that you are a flawed, inadequate human being, we see it having a lot of negative repercussions for people.
And the negative repercussions can be quite significant.
This is Dr. Triano.
The shame can be thought of as existing on a continuum from the bearable to the unbearable. The unbearable end of the continuum is feeling dehumanized, feeling demoralized, and you lose all connections with others. And there's also cognitions of helplessness and hopelessness. And you perceive yourself in the eyes of others as being deformed in some way, disgusted, although they don't feel that. And that can lead to all kinds of extreme reactions. For example, suicide bombers. There are studies showing that some of the suicide bombers, these Islamic women who felt that they had been shamed in some way, then make restitution by committing a heinous act. Well, you have gangs in which we have the new colloquialism of being dissed. And if you're someone who disses you, not only to you or to your tribe, if you will. And speaking of tribe, that's one of the things that the shame can do, that you're so ostracized from the group that no one can mention your name. And you have no access to being back to the community. That's why solitary confinement is so painful, because you're removed from connection to others. And that's what we're basically about. Meaning is established by important relationships. That's how we have purpose and meaning. And someone who is suffering from that kind of shame is really removed from that and the healing process.
We often, building off of that, we often will see two levels of shame that can make it so difficult. So in the examples I talked about where the individual feels shame about some aspect of their social performance, for example, with social anxiety, or about their appearance with body dysmorphic disorder, not only are they ashamed about that aspect of themselves, but they also have shame about having that experience. So it's sort of, shame about the shame in some ways. Mm-hmm. And as a result, what we see is it's hard for people to share what they're going through with others. And that adds to that social isolation that Dr. Triano was talking about. And so we see shame not only about the flaw that they perceive, but also shame about being in this situation in the first place and having these kinds of symptoms or having these disorders or problems.
Bethany Teachman, this new study that you co-authored that appears in a new issue of the Journal of Clinical Psychological Science is about implicit shame and its role in certain kinds of disorders, some of which you've been mentioning. But I'm curious about that term implicit shame, Bethany. Does that mean a kind of shame that you're not even aware you have?
Yeah, it's a great question. So this work was co-authored with Elise Clerkin, April Smith, and Ulrika Bullman. And we looked at people with these different disorders. And what we had them do was complete a measure that looked at the associations of themselves as being shameful as opposed to being acceptable. And we had them do a task that looks at these associations outside of conscious control or awareness. And so the idea is that there is one level of shame that we can report to individuals, that we can sort of consciously think about and introspect upon, but also that at a very automatic level, we have very rapid ways of processing information in our environment. And at this very automatic, rapid level, we see that people who have these different disorders associate themselves with being shameful when it's tied to their particular areas of concern. So for the person with body dysmorphic disorder, we find that they associate their appearance, for example, as being shameful very rapidly and differently than other people do. For the person who has obsessive compulsive disorder, they associate their thoughts as being shameful, again, at this very automatic level, using tasks that make it difficult to sort of portray a particular type of response. So it's hard to control your responding on these tasks, and yet we still see these responses appearing. And that's why we infer that it's happening at this very automatic level, because there isn't time on these tasks to sort of consciously reflect about how you feel or change your answer so you'll appear a certain way. And yet we still see that at this automatic level, people have these associations about themselves that are really quite self-critical and quite demeaning. They literally think their appearance is shameful, or their thoughts are shameful, or something about themselves is shameful. And so it's happening in these really fundamental ways for individuals.
Our guest, clinical and research psychologist Bethany Teachman, clinical and research psychologist Lenny Echterling, and psychoanalyst Raphael Triana. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, but we only have Dr. Teachman with us for a few more minutes before she has to hurry off to another appointment. So, Bethany, let me focus on you for the few minutes we've got left with you. In this new study, or in your work in general, everything that you're finding out about shame and its role in disorders or problems in life, are you finding anything about what people can do about it?
Yes, we do see that certain kinds of treatments can lead to reductions in shame. And while we don't know exactly what the mechanisms are, so exactly what aspects of treatment are leading to those reductions, we have some reasonable guesses. So, for example, helping people normalize these kinds of experiences is likely to reduce shame, we think. So making it acceptable to talk about these experiences, because they're actually not as unique as people imagine. Because we don't typically talk about them, when someone is having these intrusive thoughts, for example, in the context of obsessive compulsive disorder, they think they're the only one, and that contributes to the shame. So normalizing these experiences and making it okay to talk about them is one step. The other things that we do are help people to evaluate themselves more broadly. So if you are only basing your self-worth on the one thing about yourself that you hate, it's not surprising that you're going to feel shame and feel that you're not an adequate person. Whereas if you're able to reflect on yourself as a full and complex and multidimensional person who has both strengths and weaknesses just like every other person, then it becomes easier to put perceived flaws or transgressions in some kind of a context. And so we help people to build a sort of broader sense of themselves and to normalize the difficult experiences that they're having. And we think all of those factors can help to reduce the shame that they're experiencing. But your question is such an important one, in part because it highlights things we need to learn in the field. So we don't know enough yet about how to reduce shame, about what are the key things to make shame better. So we have lots of good ideas and lots of good things we can build on based off of other research. But this is a really important area for people to do work, because shame is a really understudied but really quite pervasive problem area.
Yeah, this is Lenny here. And I know that in my work with trauma survivors, the normalizing experience is very powerful when we do it in groups. And that can be something for vets as well as for disaster survivors, as well as for first responders, when we come together to find out, I am not alone in this, that there are others here who are having the similar feelings and the same kinds of thoughts and reactions. And it seems to be something that's powerfully, universally human.
There are some people who the shame is such a powerful experience that it's wordless. And they have no words for it, because especially when it's unconscious or implicit, they have certain personality types that their whole constellation of behaviors is to protect themselves against vulnerability and shame. There's our language in psychology and psychiatry, narcissism is a terrible term because it's so dehumanizing.
I want to follow up on that.
Okay.
But before we hit the break, let me note that Dr. Bethany Teachman is director of the Program for Anxiety, Cognition, and Treatment Lab at the University of Virginia, as well as an associate professor of psychology at UVA. Dr. Teachman, I realize that you have to go right off to another appointment, but thank you so much for carving some time out for us today.
Bye, Bethany.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Beth.
Still with us, researchers and mental health counselors Lenny Echterling and Raphael Triana. So we will continue this discussion right after a short break. As a sergeant in the U.S. Marines, the University of Virginia's Rafael Triana was awarded the Bronze Star for Valor after leading more than 50 long-range reconnaissance missions during the Vietnam War. Later, in studying for his doctorate in social work, his research focused largely on post-traumatic stress among Vietnam vets. Also with us from James Madison University, Doctor of Psychology Lenny Echterling. In addition to co-authoring some college psychology textbooks, Dr. Echterling also works with a volunteer team that supports firefighters, police, and other emergency responders. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Rafael, I realize I cut you off when we were just getting to fascinating stuff you were telling us about personality types. And I do want to ask you more about that. But first, tell us a little bit about PTSD, military veterans, and this hidden issue of shame.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said earlier, there's studies now that show that shame is more predictive of PTSD than the actual combat experience. That was about 1,200 men and women who were studied from retrospectively in the early 90s. And there's been similar studies since then that kind of show that correlation. One way to think about it is that, let's say we have, now especially with this war, two or three tours. And in between these tours, a soldier has to come back and readjust life. That can be really exhausting after a while. Given the degree of combat and what goes with that, I think the more intense the combat, the more susceptible someone is to withdraw within themselves and have a degree of shame. That is, how do you come back and talk about it? You come back to your wife and someone says, well, how was it over there? What do you say? Hey, it was all right, I'm back. So you learn to speak in euphemisms because you really can't talk about the horrors of combat that you must withstand in order to be adaptive. That's part of the job. But yet you have to sit with it. And if there's no place to really be able to talk about it, you become more isolated. And out of that can come irritability, it can come blame, it can become, he's difficult to talk to, I don't know how to reach him, and he doesn't know how to reach out. So that then makes it more obdurate. So what's very important is the transition back to civilian life is really crucial. To find forums for veterans to be able to speak about what happened in places that were safe. Lenny was talking earlier about groups. You know, the Greeks, what they did is they told stories, Sophocles, Ajax, and they would come back and they would have these plays, which were stories, but it was really a communal psychotherapy. There were rituals of purifications where they were welcomed back, and the play showed what was going on, and there was a vocabulary to discuss it. You weren't so isolated within that experience. So that in the healing process, it's being able to begin to talk about horrific things that happen that other people will find horrified and maybe be disgusted by. And you don't want to put that on them, so you have to stay alone with the experience. And that's where it becomes very socially isolating, and if not socially annihilating, because you can't make contact because you're within this very powerful experience.
And to expand on that, this is Lenny, expand on that, not only is that true for the war vets, but it's also true for survivors of, say, sexual assault.
Yes.
And which... in one survey, 75% of all sexual assault survivors felt shame regarding that experience, mm-hmm. and often a tendency to blame themselves for this horrific event and to isolate themselves as well and be reluctant to share it with others. Right. And again, that's why group forum and stories, being able to come together to create survival stories out of those trauma stories, can be so essential.
There's actually a group called... started by a fellow named Brian Durie's The Theory of War. And he has a grant from the Pentagon, the DOD, the Defense Department, and they go around the world, actually, to military bases, and they'll show an excerpt from one of the plays and actors, and then they'll talk about Ajax, for example, and his suicide, and then they'll get the soldiers to start talking about what it was like, how they can understand what Ajax did. And it creates a community then with people there. Well, you don't really have to talk about your experience per se with the gory details, but a sense of, I suffered something quite significant, and this is a place for me to be able to come and speak about it.
And suffering is an important word here, because these post-traumatic stress disorder is often, we talk about fear and anxiety. Mm-hmm. However, the deeper emotions of suffering and the shame about that are often hidden.
Yeah, and that's why you have so much substance abuse when there's so much shame. Because shame lowers esteem. And so there's a fear then.
Lowers esteem.
Personal esteem. And when your esteem goes down, you start getting depressed. So there can be a fluctuation between anxiety, I dread coming out because how I'm afraid I will be perceived if you get to know me, and then my esteem goes down and I start getting depressive symptoms because I'm so removed. The antidote to all of this is making connections. We're wired for relationship. That's where we find meaning and purpose. Whether it's attachment theory, the neurosciences, intelligent design, or God's design, one place they all agree on is relationships are core. And without them, we atrophy. So when soldiers are enmeshed or embedded in shame with these experiences that are wordless, they live alone. And the key is with therapy. One of the things that makes therapy so powerful is that for the first time, you take these ideas and these fantasies and you put them into words slowly. You begin to develop a vocabulary in a relationship with someone who you begin to trust. And in that trusting relationship, and you expose yourself in increments, the exposure begins to be the healing because you feel someone gets it. And this someone who's getting it is understanding me and wants to see me back. That then allows the person to begin to practice coming out of the shell, and the healing process can begin because empathy is very, very powerful.
Most of our examples have been so far about adults, men and women in different traumatic situations. However, it is especially challenging if we're talking about children. And it's fascinating how, if you look at this from a developmental perspective, where infants don't experience shame. Mm-hmm. It's only when they get to be about 18 to 24 months that toddlers begin to be self-aware. So this fascinating experiment where you do the Rouge test with infants, where you show them a mirror, and if they're younger, they typically think that that is another interesting image of a baby. Mm-hmm. But if you secretly put some rouge on their forehead and you show them a mirror, if they're 18 to 24 months and self-aware, they will then try to wipe off that. And as human beings, we have become self-reflective, self-aware, mm-hmm. socially aware of how others see us, and begin to experience shame. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge developmentally.
Yeah. I think
from the Department of Graduate Psychology at James Madison University, Lenny Echterling is with us. In addition to authoring a number of college textbooks, Dr. Echterling has done extensive counseling work with disaster survivors around the world. Also here from the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia, Rafael Triana. He's done extensive work on PTSD among military veterans. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got some phone lines open at 888-967-2825. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. But if you would prefer to type instead of talk, then you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We're going next to Harrisonburg. John, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, what you were talking about just now, most recently, it has a lot more gravitas than what I was going to share, but what I was going to say actually corresponds to what the doctor, was speaking about 10 minutes ago, where on some gut level you have a deeply ingrained sense of shame about something about yourself. And most of my temper problem is basically exactly that any time I suddenly find myself getting excited in a conversation due to an interruption or somebody disagreeing with me, I start to feel hideous in my talking. There's certain words, certain consonants, certain syllables that feel icky. I feel like I have words that describe how I feel, like cringerly, like cringing and gingerly. That's if you're like, you know, and then if it really, really getting excited, it's like flubbering is kind of a, you know, almost a kind of a stuttering. But I feel so hideous verbally that I have a bad habit of snapping and losing my temper at that point. And so any you know, hope of correcting that would be huge.
Well, of course, you sharing that is part of the hope that's implicit, that's a seed for you continuing to grow and develop personally. And as Raphael has talked about before, the idea of this, these part of your identity that you felt, where you have this inclination to lash out in anger, is classic among survivors of war and sexual trauma as well, too.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Anger is, I like to say this, not you have anger management and such, that's an angry person. There are people who have anger versus an angry person. Anger is secondary to wound. The more wounded someone is, the more pain they've experienced, the more susceptible they are to anger, because anger is isolating. This can be powerful, but you're alone because it repels people and repeats the trauma.
Well, it seems like the anger is the habitual way of scratching the itch. The itch is the feeling hideous, and then if you get used to dealing with the itch by a form of scratching, which is anger, then you have an anger problem. It seems like, I mean, I don't know if maybe there'd be another way to scratch that itch of feeling mm-hmm. hideous, you know.
Well, John, you bring up a great metaphor for the struggle that you're having, and oftentimes what we find in our work with survivors, I found in my work, is that below the anger is the shame.
Yeah, and the shame's the wound. And that's mm-hmm. what's so hard to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's anger is a terrible experience because it's so pervasive, and then you lose contact with people. What is even worse and more painful is the wound that causes shame, and where that comes from. And when you're able to articulate that with the right person in the right relationship, and I would say a professional relationship, you begin to see in moments that you're not hideous, that hideousness is your dehumanizing yourself. No one is perfect. We have to realize that we can be imperfect and worthy of people's love. We all have our wounds. We all have our issues. That's part of the human condition. And I think people who suffer from shame, they only see that one part of themselves, and they disallow themselves from experiencing more broadly because they're sort of trapped within themselves.
John, thank you so very much for sharing that experience with us today. 888-WMRA Talk is the easy way to remember our phone number here on Virginia Insight. In all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Dr. Raphael Triana, can we get back to what you were talking about several minutes ago when it comes to shame? Some of how much somebody experiences or how deeply they experience it may be related to personality type?
Well, I want to get back to, I want to get back to something Lenny said. I think it's very important to think developmentally about shame. And we have in the colloquial statements, we've all heard, shame on you, or you have no shame.
Yes.
And you usually do it to children, because children are not able to have guilt because that's abstract. You have to have an internalized moral system, and you have to be aware of transgressions, and you have to think about reflection and what this has done to someone else, et cetera, et cetera. That's very complicated thinking. But children then, they're so attached to the other, mother and father and others, that their sense of self is reflected back onto them. So when a parent goes, bad boy, bad girl, they have a disconnect from the parent, and yet they need the parent to soothe them. So it's like a mini little trauma in the moment in which they feel terrible about themselves because the image is giving back, and the person who's there to soothe and comfort them has removed themselves because they're the source of the pain. So those kinds of things happen moment to moment. But I think, as Lenny is saying, there's too much of that over time. They become internalized into personality configurations, and a person keeps reliving that. And they stay very isolated because they feel that's how the world's going to relate to me. I'm really not worthy. And if they really know me, if I really am spontaneously at a party, they're going to think, what's wrong with this guy? And that's all in their mind. It's the good news, it's in their mind. It doesn't really exist, because no one is as terrible as they feel they are. And once you begin to realize that, as Lenny said earlier, the distinction between shame and guilt is, with shame is, there's something wrong with me, basically. And guilt is, I've done something wrong. You know what? And I think I can apologize. I can talk about it. I'll buy my wife a flower or something. But there's ways that you can actively deal with I've done something wrong rather than your whole person is robbed and the dehumanization of that. And it's, again, on a continuum.
And we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of transactions that children and adolescents go through where they've learned that particular expectation about how someone else will deal with me as an imperfect human being.
And I think one of the things that happens to veterans in terms of the intense combat's on a continuum. And I think the more severe the combat, the more painful is the readjustment. And there can be, I think, a regression from moral standing people who experience guilt as a basic value in terms of having an internalized value system. But I think war over time, a person can regress back into shame because it becomes so wordless. I remember once going into an infantry unit and we were going to have this large operation and they had been exposed for months. And it was like walking into, I remember the book, Lord of the Flies. Mm-hmm. When I read that book, I remember this group. We would just sort of drop in and be pulled out. And there was something that they were just in a different space. And when you have that multiple tours and you keep entering that space, you never can really adjust out of it. And I think that moral fiber can then regress back into just shame without guilt, which is a higher order moral value. So the healing process is finding a place to become human again and discussing what it's like. And that's why the power of empathy and in a relationship is also, you know, we now have neurobiological studies of the brain differentiating the difference between guilt and shame. And shame is more complex and it's more pervasive and it's embedded in the part of the brain that's the emotional part of the brain. The thinking part of the brain gets involved with shame. And that's how isolated a person becomes within themselves. But in using language and beginning to talk about it, you go from the emotion into words with the therapist. And there's this phenomenon called oxytocin, which is a neuropeptide, and it's a source of trust. And trust is elicited in relationships in which you form an attachment and you trust the person. So actually, there's a neurobiology to healing in psychotherapy where trust and empathy are just not words, but they really activate new modalities in the brain that for someone isolated within shame begins to humanize them. This guy gets me. He understands me.
And as Bethany was talking about the psychotherapeutic techniques that have been more effective with addressing these concerns are often those where the client is beginning to see that connection and that attunement, brain-to-brain kind of attunement, and so that therapists now are actually doing brain surgery because those neuropathways get changed.
Right. This is Virginia Insight. We're going to continue this fascinating discussion. I've got so many questions. You got some? We got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Rafael Triana, psychoanalyst. Lenny Echterling, psychologist. We'll continue in a bit more than 1 minute. Here in the Insight Studio, psychoanalyst in private practice, as well as member of the University of Virginia's psychiatry department, Dr. Rafael Triana, plus private practice therapist, as well as professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University, Dr. Lennis Echterling. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. So either one of you, am I likely to have more problems with shame if I'm a certain type of person?
Well, I think it's a certain type of person who's had certain experiences throughout one's life and that we are not isolated islands, so that who we are is a result of all of our interactions that we've had with the important people in our lives. And that's why I think, for example, your work, Rafael, with adolescents, where that's often a period where the heightened shame reemerges for developmentally for everyone. It's not just PTSD or OCD. It's the human condition, especially in adolescence, to have that.
Yeah. I think that I like the idea of this developmental model that Nani's talking about. So I was talking about early development, where, you know, shame on you with a parent. And then you have late adolescence, which is a period of heightened change. More changes go on in the 4 years. If you look at a freshman and a senior in college, they look like two different people. But developmentally, the tasks that they have in order to become mature adults can be then sources of challenges. And the challenges then, based on certain background factors from their development, can make them very susceptible to shame.
I don't know if it's a cultural thing, Raphael, but it seems to me that in our society, many people associate the term shame with something connected to sex. So you were talking about adolescence. That leaves me wondering if as a young human being hits puberty and goes into early adolescence, if there's a lot of problem with shame getting buried because of feelings about sex that they don't understand.
Sure, it can manifest in different ways. That's a developmental task. But let's say this young person was bullied in latency, which is sort of middle school. And the bullying was pretty pervasive. And the child never had a place to talk about that. And it feels there's something really wrong with me juxtaposed to the bullier. So that child then goes through pubescence, goes through high school, maybe college. And at some point, the developmental task of becoming a sexual person, of feeling intimate feelings of emotional and arousal sexually, and want to begin to express that, but feel so concerned about how they're being perceived and so inadequate that they have problems functioning sexually, which reinforces the shame. And that's one of the tasks of adolescent development, is becoming a sexual person, beginning to experiment and figure out themselves in those kinds of intimate relationships. Separating from parents is another task. And separating from parents, suddenly they feel overly dependent because they don't have the autonomy, the wherewithal to establish social relationships, because social relationships are dangerous because they're going to know there's something wrong with me. That sense of development where the person feels there's something wrong with me as a human being. And if I'm spontaneous, they're going to know that. So you find people who are shy and they're sitting in a party and they're looking down, giving off cues that I'm unavailable essentially. They're experiencing the people as danger. People are thinking this person is not available. Then they come into therapy and you begin to talk to them about the way you're acting. Sure, people are thinking that you're not available, you're not interested. They don't even say hello because they don't want to be intrusive. So you have to look up and engage. Now, that's going to be hard. So we're going to have some practice sessions and they're going to practice that, and we come back and talk about the difficulty. But in talking about the shame, the sense of, you know, that's a nice word, but it's an experience of, I am less human. I am not worthy of your attention. When they share that with you in the relationship and you talk about that, the talking actually modifies anxiety.
And then, you know, the foundation of that shame versus autonomy that's going on in preschoolers, if that's not developed and addressed, then later on through adolescence and young adulthood and as we continue with our lives, all of those get somehow handicapped.
Dr. Lenny Eckerling, in your work with people who've been through disasters, can you explain to me why somebody who survived an earthquake may be having difficulty with shame?
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, because people who have interpersonal traumas in which they are often sanctioned in secret are much more likely to have shame. So that if you have something that broadly hit pretty much everyone, it's already normalized. You know, we are in this community, and it's the use of the word we actually increases following public traumas, so that there's a less a sense of isolation and personal alienation, but more of a sense of community. So we had this in World War II, for example, after 9/11, etc., and natural disasters as well. So there's not as much shame at those, because people aren't blaming themselves and seeing it's something wrong with me and my identity here. And therefore, there's a lot of resilience that can come about in many ways much more easily as a result of that.
So help me out with something. Based on what I've been hearing from the two of you, what we heard from Dr. Bethany Teachman earlier in the hour, shame can play a critical role in any number of disorders.
Yes.
But there are also, I'm understanding from you, and I would imagine most anybody listening would agree, ways in which shame can negatively impact most anybody's life.
Yes.
One thing that I've gotten from the three of you, especially if somebody does not feel like they want or they're able to engage in some kind of psychotherapy, that they need to do for themselves to deal with shame and to minimize its negative impact is to avoid isolation. Am I getting that right?
Yes. I mean, and I would put it more positively of reaching out to others to practice what Raphael talked about of looking someone in the eye and saying, here's my experience, here's who I am, and to begin sharing that more and more and getting that, going away from that vicious cycle to one that's a more benign, growth-inducing, post-traumatic growth potential that's there.
So Lenny and Raphael, tell me more either about that or any other strategies that you can offer people for getting away from shame being a problem in one's life.
Well, I'll speak more to the veteran group. And as I said before, it's the worst kind of trauma is when it's people to people, when it's of a human yes. design. That is, I mean, an earthquake, a fire can be horrendous. But when it's one observing someone being killed or killing, that when it's a personal sexual assault, when it's person to person, there's something very unique about that. There's a violation of something that's very innate to us, which is being human, and these are inhuman acts, if you will, and they're extreme. So that the self becomes, when there's too much of that, becomes so preoccupied with that that it begins then to distort reality outside, and you get isolated. The way to come out of that, the antidote, is to engage. If you come back, you have concentric circles. You have my family, brothers, sisters, parents. That's where you can slowly begin to practice talking about what it was like, not necessarily in the details. And when that's not enough, then you need professional help because you need that more one-on-one. But I want to pick up something that Lenny said is very important. It's post-traumatic growth. There's a work of Richard Tedeschi at UNC who's developed this concept, and they're now applying it to veterans. You know, 70% of the Vietnam veterans who came back from the war had an experience of post-traumatic growth, and 60% of prisoners of war had the same thing. So
define post-traumatic growth for us.
Well, it's a process of dealing with the trauma. And Lenny, you've written on resiliency, mm-hmm. and making sense out of it. Purpose and meaning. What happened to me, I was part of a group of men. This was war. Self-sacrifice is a sine qua non of all military character, if you will, that they have to regain what they lost. Military character is basically self-sacrifice at a very fundamental level. Engagement, the way you work as a unit, as bands of men, if you will, is really virtue, because the way you interact with each other is behaviors that takes the other into consideration. That's virtue, interpersonal processes. So there's something very virtuous about military training and actually combat, the way you cohere as a group and you have a person's back. The veterans have to regain that because they've lost it and they've only seen the dark side. So growth is beginning to realize bad things happen. I participated in bad things. There was a reason why that happened, and there's a healing, as I put it into words, and I remember the sense of community, the sense of purpose, the traditions. You know, TAPS is such a powerful experience, and it's ritual. That's what I was saying before. The Greeks had these ritualized purification processes, the sense of symbol, the sense of ritual. And so when you get back into that and you regain that, and spirituality is a very important part of this, because one of the values of the military is transcendent. One, in purpose, self-sacrifice, but two, they tend to be religious. So getting back into those values and regaining the self that was lost before combat.
You know, I want to highlight a particular point that Raphael made, and that is that the majority of veterans experience post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
The majority.
Yes.
And that is true not only for veterans, but also for civilians as well, too. And that's something that's often ignored out there in the public, is that if someone has a traumatic experience, that doesn't mean that they're going to limp through life as a victim, that in many ways, through that suffering and that turmoil and finding meaning, making meaning out of that, they come out at a higher level of purpose in their life, yeah, of sensitivity, and of wisdom.
So, Lenny, we're here today in part because you suggested this wonderful topic to me a few weeks ago.
And this has been great.
We've only got a few minutes left. What about the topic of shame, about recovering from it, dealing with it, have we not touched on yet?
I think one part of this that I found very satisfying today is to hear from both Raphael and Bethany regarding their work and the deep insights that brings to this. I would like to build a bit on that spirituality piece. I just came back from working with a group of folks in Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, and so we have Mexican and Texan helpers who are counselors and pastoral counselors, as well as just religious leaders who are dealing with tremendous amount of violence in those areas. And I came back completely inspired by this. I did not come back demoralized. I did not come back feeling any sort of shame. In fact, I felt a sense of pride about the humanity. And I think that's part of this, that we've come to authentic pride. The literature, for example, on aging is that as we grow older, we become wiser and our well-being and happiness increases. And some of that is not because we're lucky in avoiding illness. It's because we are now becoming more human than otherwise.
I just wanted to add something that Lenny said earlier, is that therapists need to be more alert to shame.
Yes.
I think a lot of therapists are not aware of the power and meaning of shame, where they confuse it with guilt. In my experience has been that most often anxiety, to use the word disorders, are secondary to shame, and often depression, because shame induces fear of other. The other is not someone I want to get close to. I can't, because they pose a danger. They may discover my worthlessness. So that creates anxiety, social anxiety, and other types of anxiety. The other is it lowers esteem and can create depression, which is further withdrawal, and then reinforces the shame. So I think it really behooves therapists to really think about shame in disorders of anxiety or depression. I hate the word disorders. I mean, PTSD, it should be post-traumatic stress injury, because it's really an injury. But the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of American Psychiatric Association, is our Bible, which is the Bible of bad names. We have these terrible terms that really dehumanize people. It's important. We need it for research and continuity of care, et cetera. But we also have to be careful of the dehumanization. That's why sometimes I feel trouble talking about PTSD and humility and humiliation, because it then can take away the person's humanity. PTSD is suffering. Anxiety is suffering. Anxiety, depression, those are forms of suffering. Pathology is pathos. We have to give them this nomenclature, because it's important as clinicians, and we need the research like Bethany's doing to help inform us clinicians about how to help our patients. But at the same time, we have to take a step back and think that these are all people, and we all suffer from the human condition. Some of us have a harder row than others and have more suffering out of that. But basically, we're all in this kind of together.
Yes, we want to label jars and not people.
Yeah.
And we also want to highlight the potential for growth that we, mm-hmm, we know is there, and that people may not recognize within themselves, and that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, has all sorts of discussions regarding anxiety and depression, et cetera, very little about suffering and true, yeah, shame.
Yeah. Anxiety and depression are preoccupation within one's mind, and they can't get out and engage with the world. That's profound suffering.
Lenny Echterling, since we began with you, I'm going to end with you. In the 20 seconds we have left, somebody listening who's saying, my first step is not going to be to seek out counseling, but give me some good advice on how I can make my life better and get away from hidden emotions. What's that good advice?
Well, part of this is that we often hide these emotions from ourselves so that we are an audience to our own awareness and our own souls and our own being. Therefore, part of this is take time to reflect, to be engaged in prayerful, meditative self-reflection, to explore this. And writing, for example, is one of the things that Tedeschi has found helpful to explore, as well as just sitting down and taking time for oneself to see what's my meaning and purpose in life and how do I fit in attachments to others, attachments to nature, and
attachments to God. I'm so sorry, we're out of time. Our guests have been from James Madison University, member of the Graduate Psychology Department, Dr. Lenny Echterling, plus from the University of Virginia, member of the Psychiatry Department, Dr. Rafael Triana, as well as earlier in the program, research and clinical psychologist from UVA, Bethany Teachman. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.